Okay, we are in the middle of Perek Tetvav, chapter 15. We are at Pasuk Ches, sentence 8. We have already seen... We have already seen the southern boundary of Yehuda, and we talked about just how far south that goes, Eilat being out, and so forth. Nachal Mitzrayim in the west, is that the Nile, Wadi Al-Arish. We talked about the eastern boundary, which was the easy one, using the Yarden. We talked about the northern boundary, and saw it go from the east, from Yam HaMelach, across to Yerushalayim, and the last bit that we had seen in Pasuk Chet, in sentence 8, we saw it passing through Gei Ben Hinnom, that infamous valley, and we talked about the Gemara in Zvachim, about how there was a desire to build it at the highest possible point, and that was Ein Itim, and then they decided to move it down a little bit, and we gave two different reasons why they would have not gone with the highest point. Idea number one is because the pasuk says "Bank Seifav Shachin," that the Beis Hamikdash is between his shoulders, literally, as is described in the bracha for Binyamin, and so it's sort of recessed a little bit. It's not at the height. And the other explanation being that we're taught that it's supposed to be on land that is shared, or not shared, but split between Yehuda and Binyamin. And if you do it at Ein Itim, that's too far into Binyamin. You won't be able to build the building and include Yehuda space as well as Binyamin space. Those are two explanations brought in the Gemara. But what that leads us to have to ask is what you see here in source number one, which is, who owns Yerushalayim? And this question was asked a little bit last time, I think, when we first noticed that Yerushalayim does not end up in Yehuda. And so the question is, who actually does own Yerushalayim? And the answer, of course, is it's a machlokas. We have two views. Source number one, the Gemara in Yuma says, B'maika miflagi, they're dealing with a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim on a separate point, and they want to know what's the debate between these two sages really about. Tanakama savra Yerushalayim lo nischalka l'shvatim. The first view in the argument, that's the view of the Chachamim of the sages, says Yerushalayim is not divided among the tribes. It's like a Washington, D.C., you know, where no one actually owns it. It's its own entity. It doesn't really apply with Ottawa, right? No. Ottawa is owned by Quebec. Right? No, Ontario. Ontario. It's close to Quebec. It's close. They have signs that are in French there, okay? Yeah, Gatineau goes into Quebec. So,
that's... You're going to fail that citizenship
test. It's not happening sometime soon, anyway. But Yerushalayim is not divided up, according to the Tanakhama. Rabbi Yehuda Savar Yerushalayim Nischalka L'Shvatim. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, Yerushalayim is indeed divided up. And the truth is that it's a separate debate among Tanoim, among the sages from the time of the Mishnah, as follows. Disanya. Mahaya Bechelko Shel Yehuda. The first view in this source that we're quoting says, what was in Yehuda's portion from Yerushalayim? Har Habayit, the Temple Mount, Halashachos, the Ha'azara, as well as offices and rooms, outer areas of the Beis Hamikdash on Har Habayit. Umahaya Bechelko Shel Binyamin, what was in Binyamin's portion? Ulam Vehechal Ubeis Kadshe HaKadashim, these are rooms within the Beis HaMikdash itself, and really these are the rooms where the action is, where the Mizbeach is, where the Menorah is, the Shulchan, the Kodesh Kadashim, the Holy of Holies, that's all Binyamin's. Uritzua Haisa Yotz Amechelko Shal Yehuda Vinichneses Lechelko Shal Binyamin Ubahaya Mizbeach Banui. However, there's a small strip of land from Yehuda's portion that enters into where Binyamin is, and that includes the Mizbeach. And Binyamin always wanted it and was upset they didn't have it. Unclear to me whether this means the original Binyamin, like Binyamin ben Yaakov knows prophetically where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be and so on, or whether this refers to the Shevet of Binyamin, the tribe of Binyamin, that they're upset that they have the Beis HaMikdash but they don't have a place where the Karbanos are brought. That remains with Yehuda. Where do we get that idea from? Shenamar, because this pasuk where Moshe gives the bracha to Binyamin, it says Chofeif Alav Kol Hayom, which can be rendered as he covers it all day long. There are other ways to render the word Chofeif, but the way it's understood there is that he's hovering over it like, I want this. That's the idea. So the statement here is that it is split with part in Yehuda and part in Binyamin. Lefichach zacha Binyamin atzadik v'nasa ushpizcham legevura shenema uven kisefav shachin, which is why, as the pasuk continues, Binyamin does get to host the Beis HaMikdash in general as a reward for his love for hosting Hashem. At least he gets to have the Beis HaMikdash, even if he doesn't have the Shechina. So that's one view.
Doesn't Harabai encompass what Binyamin has? Like, isn't everything built on Harabai?
Right. So, if I remember correctly, Rashi there clarifies when it says Harabai, it means the areas around the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't mean the entire mountain. Okay. Right. V'haytana Sava, Yerushalayim lo nischak l'shvatim. But on the other hand, I have another brisa that says Yerushalayim is not divided up. Tisanya ein maskirin batim b'Yerushalayim l'fi she'ein ashelahen. I have a brisa that says you're not allowed to rent out homes in Yerushalayim because it doesn't belong to you. And it's talking about Aliyah L'Regel. When people come for Yom Tov, they have to end up borrowing space in people's homes. You're not allowed to rent out to them. You can't charge rent. And then the Hebrew actually continues. I see that I didn't bring it. Probably because I was trying to cram it in. But I don't know. But anyway, you see it in my English translation. I translated it there. I just knocked it out of the Hebrew. Rabbi Elazar Shimon says you also can't rent out a bed there. Even the bed cannot be rented out. Even though you'll say, well, I'm not renting out the house. I understand the house is jointly owned by all the Jews. But this is my bed, right? Nonetheless, even that, you're not allowed to rent out.
But then how do people... Who live there, how they kind of lay claim to living in that house.
Right. So it's more or less like the 99-year rent idea, right? Which applies, frankly, in, I think, all of Israel. You know, you don't actually own property. You're getting a 99-year lease from JNF or whatever. But I think that's basically the arrangement, that they don't actually own it. So that's the debate there. Where in the world does this debate come from? Like, who gave the Gemara the idea that there should be, you know, that it shouldn't be divided up among everybody? The idea that it partially is one Sheva, partially is another Sheva, so Ralbag anchors this somewhat in our Psukim in source number 2. He says, Yidme mizeh ha-makom, Yerushalayim lo nischak l'shvatim. He says, if you look at the verses that we read, it sounds very clear that Yehuda stops south of Yerushalayim, right? The border, we said, runs through Gei Ben Hinnom. We had the laptop, and, you know, we saw where the border was running.
See where Binyamin starts? Like, I know we're not there yet, but is there a gap between where Yehuda, like, it's all...
Right, it sounds like Binyamin is right to that border.
Right to
we haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like Binyamin is to the border. And in any case, it's certainly not going to be in Yehuda. So, V'ula Masha Amar Achar Zeh, but he says the trick is what's coming later on in this chapter. Hypothetically, we would get to this today, but we won't. There's a very long list of cities in between. But at the end of the list of cities, it says, "As Hayavusi Yoshvei Yerushalayim lo yachlu b'nei Yehuda laharisham." The pasuk is going to say, the Yavusi, who lived in Yehuda, Yehuda could not conquer them. Vayeshev haYevusi as bnei Yehuda b'Yerushalayim, and the Yevusi lived with Yehuda in Yerushalayim. That pasuk is the problem. The boundary stops short of Yerushalayim, but Yehuda is living there. How do I understand that? Yoresh Yerushalayim haysam minachlas bnei Yehuda. That indicates that it is part of Yehuda. Kilo amar lo yachlu bnei Yisrael laharisham, ach amar lo yachlu bnei Yehuda laharisham. It didn't say the Jews couldn't take it. It said Yehuda couldn't take it. He says, when you look at the list of Binyamin's cities, which is going to show up in another few chapters, it's going to include Yevusi, which is Yerushalayim in his list. So Yidmek Yerushalayim Haisim Minachlas Bnei Binyamin. I guess that means it's really in Binyamin's land. Which is why there's a debate. Because effectively, we're getting contradictory evidence from the Psukim. That's our reason why we have this problem.
Are they arguing whether or not it belonged to a little section belonged to all of the Shvatim or only between the two, Yehuda and Binyamin?
Right. So that depends on which view I take. Right. If I take the view, in other words, there are two ways you can resolve this problem. One way to resolve the problem is to say everyone has access to the city. Which is why, even though it's in Binyamin's greater portion, if you look where the borders are, Binyamin, where they go, they do run to the south of Yerushalayim. Nonetheless, Yehuda could have been trying to conquer the Yebusi because it's everybody's. And so that's one solution, is that it's this little oasis in the middle of Binyamin, or southern part of Binyamin, that isn't Binyamin's, but in fact it belongs to everyone and everyone has access. The other solution is, this isn't everyone's, it's Yehuda's, by dint of this pasuk that says they were trying to conquer it, that shows that it was theirs, and therefore it's actually Yehuda's city, or at least, you know, some of it is Yehuda's city, the part with Harabayas is Yehuda's city, within Yerushalayim. You follow? Those are the two options. Okay. So from here, the boundary continues west. And I didn't remind you about the laptop, because I figured we can actually swing this without it. It's okay. The laptop in some ways helps, but in some ways doesn't. And if anybody wants, you know, like, I can send you, like, GPS things. You can find it on Google Maps at home. But if you take a look at Pasuk Tes, sentence 9, we're now across Gei Ben Hinnom. So we are now southwest of the old city. V'ta'ar ha-gevul me'rosh ha-har el ma'ayan me'neftalach. The boundary then at ta'ar, and ta'ar we understand to mean that it swivels a little bit, it turns a little bit, it's not a straight line. From the top of the mountain that was on the western side of Gei Ben Hinnom, el ma'ayan me'neftalach, to the spring of Neftalach, which, according to what I researched a little bit, is northwest of the mall, the Mamula Mall. Give you a picture where that is. The western edge of Romema, that area. Western or eastern? I wrote western in my notes, but I'm actually
like
questioning
southwest
that.
Southwest.
Well, the right.
And so this would be like, okay, so just...
Mm-hmm. Just past that.
Okay.
So north of the old city.
No, south of the old city. Northwest of the mall, which is southwest of the city. The mall is southwest of the city. You're on the northwestern, you're northwest of that mall. So you've gone further west of the city, and you're not exactly south anymore because it is curving up a little bit. But it's not like north of the old city. If the old city is here, okay, gummy worms. If this is the old city, you've gone from being here to being somewhere here, as I understand it.
This being north.
This being north, this being south, right.
Is that on the way to, on the way to Mea Shearim area?
I have a hard time
over this way.
Yeah, in general, spatially, I'm a disaster.
I drove, so I learned.
We're saying this person is Shearim, y'all go down to Mamula, but you're thinking
about getting lost.
I drove the city, so
it's hard in Yerushalayim to navigate so easily.
Certain understanding of certain places by driving.
Makes sense.
That would be up there. Very hard to.
Okay. So you're going west. You're arcing a little bit north as you go west. V'yatsa el arei Har Ephron. You then go to the cities or the villages of Har Ephron, which is the area of Motza, west of Romema. If you remember all the signs for Motza, when you're entering Yerushalayim, you see signs for Motza. There's Motza, there's Motza Elit. The Ta'ar HaGavul Ba'ala Hi Kiryati Arim. And the border then turns towards this place we identify as Ba'ala. Dan Mikra thinks that's the area of Abu Ghosh. Which, remember I talked about last time, Route 1 that runs east-west? That's really what you want to track because it's more or less on the border. So this, if you go west on Route 1, you're going to hit this area of Abu Ghosh. That's Ba'ala here, which is also called Kiryati Arim. Pasuk Yud. We're almost done with the boundary, so you know, for those who are not into the geography, we're almost done with it. V'nasav ha-gvul mi-ba'ala yama, it then turns west from there, el har Seir, to Mount Seir, va'avar al-kesef har ya'arim mi-tsafona hi-chisalon. It is to the northern side of this mountain called har ya'arim, which is also known as Kisalon. I'm not familiar with it, except that Kiryat Yearim is just northwest of Abu Ghosh on the maps.
And Har Seir?
So Har Seir is the difficult one. That is very unclear what is meant here with Har Seir. Right, because we're thinking of Har Seir of Edom.
Yeah.
Right. This, I think, has to be a different Har Seir. I don't think this can be the same Har Seir. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, because I expected Don Mikra to make a comment on it, and he had nothing to say. But it seems very clear this can't be that Har Seir. That has to be south and east. the Arad Beit Shemesh, it goes down to Beit Shemesh, V'Avar Timnah, and it goes to Timnah. So Beit Shemesh obviously is not necessarily the Beit Shemesh of today precisely, but it is that area that we're talking about. According to that mikra, it's next to Nahal Sorek. So way west now from Yerushalayim. And then to Timnah, which we know from Chumash, that's where Yehuda. Well, before we get to Shimshon, you're right. It's there also, but when Yehuda goes to shear his sheep, it's in Timnah. This city itself of Timnah is going to end up in Dun's portion, which you know because you just said it's Shimshon. Shimshon being from Dun, so the city itself will be in Dun, but the outskirts perhaps are in Yehuda. That's that Mikra's suggestion. On Google Maps, it is somewhere west of Nahal Sorek. There's a city called Timnah, but whether it's the original or not, I can't say. And then, the last bit. V'yatzah ha-gevul el-kesef Ekron tzafona. The border goes to the edge of Ekron to the north. Now, the northern edge of Ekron should ring a bell, right? There are five Plishti cities, five Philistine cities. Ekron, Ashkelon, Gat, Ashdod, and Aza, right? So Ekron is the northern edge of the lands of the Plishtim. Google Maps has some place called Tel Mikneh for Ekron, for where Ekron was originally. It's what they call Tel Mikneh. So you're going now, if you know that you're in Plishti lands, you know you're near the Mediterranean already, and that you're sort of the southern edge of that. V'ta'ar ha-gevul Shikrona, the boundary turns towards Shikron, which Da Mikra does not know where it is. Same for Google Maps. V'avar har habala v'yatsa Yavne'el. It passes har habala, which we presume to be among the hills near the Mediterranean, and then Yavne'el, which Da Mikra says is Yavne. V'ayutos os ha-gevul Yama. And then you just go to the Mediterranean. From Yavne, you just go to the Mediterranean. That's your boundary, your northern boundary of Yehuda. And then he tells you the western boundary, which you already know, Ugvul Yam, the western boundary, Hayama Hagadol Ugvul. The western boundary is the Mediterranean itself, the area by the Mediterranean. Ze Gvul B'nei Yehuda Saviv U'mishpechosam. That's the boundary of Yehuda, divvied up among their families. There's more to say about that word ugvul. That's going to come up later on. Maybe we'll get to that today. We'll see. But that's the basic boundary of Yehuda. We're clear, basically, on the area that's covered? Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, there is, as I said last time, there's a nice map in the Dan Mikra on page Kuflam at Zion, which actually tries to show cities within it also. But it's nothing that you can't imagine.
Get like a visual.
Here's Yam HaMelach. Down here, if you go far enough, you'll get to the Gulf of Aqaba, but he's not even putting it in because he doesn't believe that that's where Malach Rabim is. But he is trying to show you, that it's basically down here, outside of the frame of the picture, because he doesn't go all the way to the Mediterranean, he doesn't go all the way south either, because he's interested in this picture and trying to show you where the cities are that we're going to list. And those cities are really all here. You don't get a lot of cities down in the Negev for obvious reasons. So, that's your area, and here's your northern boundary between Yehuda and Binyamin, running this way. They actually have maybe it's a better picture. Yeah, Yehuda's getting a lot of ground. We already talked about how large that area is. There's another picture here, which actually does a better job in the sense of, omitting a lot of dotted lines. The only thing is that you could be left with a false impression that it goes all the way down here, which it doesn't. That's that being way down. Okay. Actually, Eilat is here. There's Eilat. Okay. So, that brings us to a whole new range of problems. Okay? We have now figured out basically where Yehuda is, but now we have to divide it up, and we are going to meet Kalev once again. Right, we already saw Kalev earlier when he came to Yehoshua and said, Hashem promised me and I am still capable of conquering and I would like the land of Hebron. And after like 10 psukim from Kalev, Yehoshua said, okay. And then we moved on from there. But now we see what actually happens with the city of Hebron. So we are up to Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ulechalev ben Yefunen nasan chelak besoch bnei Yehuda el pi Hashem li Yehoshua. Tukalev ben Yefunen. The portion within Yehuda was given at God's word, meaning as Hashem had said to Yehoshua, et Kiryat Arba Avi Ha'anak, hi Chevron, the city of Arba, who was the Papa Giant, Avi Ha'anak, right? We talked about that last time, or whenever it was. Hi Chevron, that city is Chevron. Vayoresh Misham Kalev es Shlosha Bnei Ha'anak, and Kalev conquers there the three sons of the giant, as Sheshai ves Achiman ves Tamai, Yilidei Ha'anak. Sheshai, Achiman, Tamai, we've already seen them before, and they are Yilidei Ha'anak, the sons of the giant. It's interesting to note that the last two words there were redundant. You already said Bnei Ha'anak. Why do you say Yilidei Ha'anak there as well?
Maybe
those were the children. Maybe. Well, what that mikra does is he suggests that it's meant to run parallel to the language used in the Chumash. When they're described in the Chumash, they're described this way: Shamach Yimash Shai B'Tamah B'Tamah Yilidei Ha'anak. It's almost like your last name. Like they will always be named with Yilidei Ha'anak, which I single out as important because I had someone ask me the other day whether the Jews in the time of the Navi have access to Chumash. Because you don't really find a lot of like description of them sitting and studying Torah. When you go into the Gemara, they talk about Jews learning Torah in those days. But if you look in the Navi, you don't find a whole lot about it. So I did show him various psukim that do have Jews learning Torah. Like, it's there. It's not gone, so to speak, especially the time of David and Shlomo. We find psukim relating to both of them that speak of study. But the other piece of it that I think is important to realize is the psukim all the way through that echo the language of Chumash. It's very clear all the way through. We saw a lot of it in the beginning of Yehoshua, when we saw the language that Reuven and Gad use when they speak to Yehoshua, and the description about the deal that had been made with Moshe, and the reiteration of what God had told Moshe to tell Yehoshua. It appears again in the beginning of the Sefer. They have access to a Chumash text. Otherwise, you aren't going to see these direct quotes from the Chumash. There's more to be said on that front, but I think that it's interesting when you see something that's so clearly, it doesn't belong. The Pasuk should have said Yilidei Ha'anak. It's entirely redundant. The only thing it's doing there is because someone knows the Pasuk in Parsha Shlach and says, I'm going to quote verbatim. Okay. Pasuk Ted Vav. If I were a cynic, I would say the Anshe Knesset HaGedola, when they canonize everything, go through and they're cleaning it up, so to speak, and matching it, but I see no reason to believe it. But the big problem with this Pasuk is not Yilidei Ha'anak. The big problem with this pasuk is from Sefer Shoftim. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4 Tanakhs around, at least. I don't know if you have Tanakh also. Yeah, you did 5 Tanakhs. Okay. So if others could look on, it's important to see what happens in Shoftim, specifically Perek Aleph. Oh, I gave it to you on the sheet. Perek Aleph, Psukim Yud to Yud Tes. If you look at those psukim, and then you look at the psukim that are going to happen here, you will notice what? The same thing. I mean, it's the same conquest, and the same story about how it's divided up, and Achsa, the daughter of Kalev. The whole story is the same. So that leads to a question. When did it happen? Did it happen in Yehoshua's time? And if so, why is it recorded in Shoftim? Did it happen in Shoftim? Well, then why is it recorded in Yehoshua? So, you will not be surprised once again to know that it's a debate. Rashi says that it actually happens after Yehoshua dies, and it belongs in Shoftim. It's recorded here because we're describing the division of the land, and that is a key moment in the division of the land, so we'll introduce it here as well. But clearly that means it's introduced after the end of Sefer Yehoshua. It has to be put in back. In other words, the Gemara says, we saw this when we started this year a while back, that Yehoshua writes most of Sefer Yehoshua. He doesn't write the very end. but he writes most of it. But whoever's coming along next to record these things, maybe it's Shmuel Hanavi, is putting things into Yahushua, according to Rashi, that weren't part of the original book. Which was probably annoying if you brought the first copy, the first edition.
The editor.
You could just cut and paste it. I mean, literally you could.
Maybe it's because Otniel, right? He was one of the Shoftim. So maybe that's why they recorded it. So you're saying, well, why they recorded Yeshua?
Right.
So the
reason to put it there is because that's when it happened.
Right.
Like, it just makes sense there. But Abarbanel and Malbim, as well, in their commentaries to Sefer Yehoshua and their commentaries to Shoftim, and it really came up back in Perek Yud when we listed one of the kings who were conquered in that conquest of the 31 kings. One of them was Melech Hebron. So they already raised this question back there. They said it happened in Yehoshua's lifetime. The only reason it's reported there is because the first Perek of Shoftim talks about Yehuda's conquests. So therefore it lists the conquest that happened already earlier, because it is a conquest of Yehuda. It's just that it had happened before the events in Shoftim, when Yehoshua was still alive. So we have two reasonable explanations for it. What we don't have a reasonable explanation for is what comes next. In Pasuk Tedvav. I'm sorry, back in Yehoshua, sorry. Perek Tedvav, Pasuk Tedvav. You actually could read it in Shoftim also, because like I said, these are mimic psukim. But, Vayal Misham El Yoshvei Devir. And he went up from there to the dwellers of Devir. Vishem Devir Lefanim Kiryat Sefer. The name of Devir was first Kiryat Sefer. That's an interesting name. I mean, we know that there is a Kiryat Sefer now. I don't actually think so. But Kiryat Sefer literally means the city of the book. That's an unusual name. Commentators suggest, actually, based on the Gemara, that Devir means Sefer. But he goes up to the dwellers of Devir, and Devir was once known as Kiryat Sefer, and he makes a very interesting promise. This is Kalev. Vayomer Kalev, and Kalev said, Asher Yakez Kiryat Sefer Ulchada, whoever conquers Kiryat Sefer, Venasati lo es Achsa biti liisha. So I will give him my daughter Achsa to be his bride. Anyone think that's a good idea?
No one uses that name nowadays.
No, it's very interesting. No one uses it.
I've heard other names being used.
It's not a horrible name.
Hesa.
Oh, come on.
People name it Pesha.
Yeah. Yeah, but at least they know who the guy is. I mean, I'm not a fan of that system, but at least you know who they are.
Yeah.
If he can do this, get a resume. If he can do this, maybe it was passed, then he must be a man of valor.
Or potentially just some, violent human being. You know, I mean, seriously, this is my test.
Well, 5 minutes, so we're doing this all the time. What this is who said the next person who comes out of the house.
Yeah, Yiftach. And boy, did he get in trouble. That was a terrible thing.
No, I think at the moment that sometimes men don't.
Guilty.
They're desperate. So.
Guilty. But seriously, I mean, at my instinct, meet your own reader. If they want to watch this video someday, you can hear it from me directly. My instinct is a son-in-law who is not a conqueror, but rather who, I can conquer. He has to be afraid of the shotgun. I'm going to get in trouble for that. So the question then is, what exactly is it that Kalev is doing here? Why does he think this is a good idea? Not to mention, it's also interesting that Kalev asks for help. Mm-hmm. Right? Remember, his whole sales pitch was, I'm still strong, I'm just like I was 40 years ago, 45 years ago. Yeah, Barbanel says, yeah, but he also got old. I mean, that's the way it goes. But the questions we have to ask here are, number one, what in the world is Kalev doing? Is this really something we approve of? Number two, what's a Kiryat Sefer? We don't find Kiryat Sefer anywhere else in Tanakh other than in this story. The story as it appears here, and then it's going to be reiterated in Shoftim, but it's the same story. And where is it in relation to Hebron? He was given a Hebron. What is he doing with Kiryat Sefer at all? So we actually have some very different ideas for what it was that Kiryat Sefer was. That Mikra, on a very literal level, says Kiryat Sefer must have been a fortress within Devir, and we know that there is a city called Devir, and that's what this is. But take a look at the Gemara in source number 4, which takes it in an entirely different direction, which is going to matter when we talk about what Caliph thought he was doing with this offer of his daughter. Amar Yehuda Marav, Bishah Sheniftar Moshe Rabbeinu Legan Eden, when Moshe was dying, Amar lo li Yoshua, he says to Yoshua, Sha'al mi meni kol sfeikos sheyeshlach, ask me anything you're unsure about, I want to be able to convey the Torah to the Jews. Amar lo, he says to him, Rabbi, my master, klumi nachticha sha achas ve'alachti l'makom acher? He says, you know, I never left you. Anything that you taught, I learned. Lo kach kasav tibi, umishar so Yoshua ben nun nar lo yamish mitocha ohel, didn't you in fact write, it's in your Torah, that I never left the tent? So, what's the question? Miad tashash kocho she Yoshua. Well, that's not exactly the right answer. Right? There's a hint of something inappropriate in giving that kind of a response to Moshe. And his strength weakens. Minishtakchu mimenu shlosh meos halachos. He forgot 300 laws. V'noldu lo shva meos sfeikos. And he developed 700 uncertainties. V'amdu kol Yisrael lahargo. And all Israel arose to kill him. Like, they were all very angry. And the Gemara plays out the story. And the question then is, well, what happened to all that he forgot? So, Amar Rabbi Avo, Avo Pikein, Hichziran Asniel ben Knaz mitoch pilpulo. He says, Asniel ben Knaz restored it via his pilpul, his analysis. He figured it out. Shnemar, as the Pasuk says, Vayilkod Asniel ben Knaz achi Kalev, Asniel ben Knaz, brother of Kalev, conquered it. And what they're doing is, they're saying that Kiryat Sefer does not mean a place. Kiryat Sefer, it means the book, the learning. And this whole story, as the Gemara here seems to be reading it, is, and the Gemara further along, coming in the Gemara in Tanis that we're going to see as well, not the Gemara, but Rashi in Tanis, is going to say that there was no physical conquest involved at all. The whole story of the conquest of Kiryat Sefer is not, I'm going to give my daughter to someone who can conquer some Canaanite city, but rather to the one who can demonstrate his learning. Hmm. Which...
And how does that interwork with the
words? Yes, so this would be difficult. There's no question that this is a difficult read. The answer would be to say, as in fact they do say in the Gemara, that Devir in Persian is Sefer. The question is, why did the Navi bother to tell me about the change of names over time? This is difficult. I mean, there's no two ways around the fact that this is difficult, but what they're trying to do is to solve our problems with the Psukim, which is, I've never heard of a Kiryat Sefer, number one, and number two, what did Kalev think he was doing? So at least, you know, people who like arranged marriages and don't like arranged marriages can have a fun debate about it, but at least we have something that Jewish tradition will recognize as a legitimate standard for demonstrating that he's a good guy. Not that he's, you know, some warrior, but that he is a fine Talmid Chacham. However, that doesn't end the story. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, the Gemara in Tanis that I mentioned before. Shlosha shalu shalo kahogen. Three people asked inappropriately. Lishnayim heshivuhu kahogen. Le'echad heshivuhu shalo kahogen. Two of them got a good answer anyway. One of them got a terrible answer. Ve'elu hein. And these are the three. Eliezer Evan Avraham. Right? When does Eliezer ask inappropriately?
Ask for the sign?
We ask for the sign, but not just for the sign. He says, whatever girl comes out and says she's going to give water to me and to the camels, she's the one. He doesn't know who's coming out or anything about her, especially, and that whole story is problematic, because that wasn't who Abraham sent him to get. Abraham said, get someone from my family. Why in the world is his standard someone who's a balas chesed? I mean, that's nice. It's an important trait. I don't minimize it. But what if it had been someone who was a balas chesed and wasn't from Avram's family? Now he's out of luck. And yet, Hashem gave him the right answer anyway. He sent him Rivka, and Rivka was the one who it was supposed to be. The second one is Shaul ben Kish. What's that story? Shaul says that whoever defeats Goliath is going to get to marry his daughter. Right? And then that ends up in a terrible saga with Michal and Merav, and that's a mess. But at least he ends up with David HaMelech. Sorry? Yes. It's all about Shiduchim. That's what this is. So the... Sorry? Yeah. Well, except that in this case, again, he's bailed out. Because at least it's David. Granted that David and Shaul, it doesn't work out so well in that sense. But at least he gets a son-in-law who's a decent person. And then the third is Yiftach HaGiladi, right? And the story with Yiftach of whatever comes out of my house first, I'm going to bring as a carbon to God, and his daughter ends up being the one to come out of the house, and that whether she is sacrificed or is not sacrificed, you can look at all the different commentaries to Sefer Shoftim. But that story reminds me of why I don't want to go from Yoshua into Shoftim next. But the point is that you have three people who are criticized here in the Gemara. Who's not on the list? Kalev isn't on the list. Why is Kalev missing from this list? It sounds like what he did is the same as what Shaul did. Right? Shaul said whoever defeats Goliath. Mm-hmm. And he said whoever defeats Kiryat Sefer. So, three answers that I've seen. One answer, which I am inclined towards just from a simplicity standpoint, and because it makes sense, we see things like this a lot, is that this Gemara stops short. The Gemara has various occasions on which it brings a list, whether a halachic list or a list about something else. And then one of the chachamim will ask, well, wait a minute, why isn't this on the list? And their answer will be, Tanav Ashayer, it mentioned certain things, it wasn't an exclusive list. It mentioned certain things, and it left out certain things. And the answer could be that there actually are more than three, but this sage, for whatever reason, communicated three. Yeah, and that works very well because, in fact, if you look at the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah to Parshas Chayisara, and I think it's elsewhere in the Medrash as well, Vayikra Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, you actually find another version of this Medrash, and Kalev is on the list. So the simplest answer is, he wasn't right. Kalev was wrong. This wasn't something he was supposed to do, just like Eliezer, just like Shaul. Ah, we respect Kalev tremendously, and he's one of the two good Meraglim, and so he's a Nasi of Yehuda, and by what right do we say anything negative about him? Good question. But that's what the Medrash does. It says he asked Shalom Gahogan, he asked inappropriately. This was not the right thing to do. And maybe it was because he had Emunah, he just thought God is going to take care of it. But as the Gemara is saying here, that's not necessarily the right thing to do. It's considered Shalom Gahogan, even when it does turn out well. When God saves Shaul, right, he saves Eliezer, they're still not right for having asked for that kind of rescue. But that's one answer.
He's human. He's human. We all make mistakes. Great.
Right. The problem that we always have, and we're not going to resolve it now, is figuring out how to juxtapose incredible greatness, like that of somebody who is willing to stand up for what's right against an entire nation. And in the context of great fear, he has seen the giants. He knows what they're up against. And yet he's willing to do that with what seems like such an obvious failing. Like, this is an easy one. Despite the fact that men find, say dumb things. Realistically... I don't know. He's not a kid. He's 85. Okay. That's one approach, is that he's not right. Second approach is Rashi's approach, and Rashi says, look back at the Gemara that we just saw in source number 4, where the Gemara said that it wasn't about conquering a city, it was about demonstrating that he is a Talmid Chacham, and he's going to restore all the laws that were forgotten. And so that shows that he's wonderful. Whether it's because that means that he's a Navi, as some of the commentators take it, that demonstrates that he's a Navi, and Hashem would only be manifest on someone who was worthy, or whether, as others take it, that it just shows he's a Talmid Chacham, because there are all sorts of philosophical complications in calling him a Navi, because a Navi isn't allowed to create new Torah, it has to be someone who did this with his pupil, with his analysis, but the point is that the second approach is that this is part of what that Gemara is saying when the Gemara says Kiryat Sefer is not a city. That Kiryat Sefer is about Torah, and that will justify what Kalev was doing in a world in which that's the way people arrange marriages. They say, look, show up at the yeshiva and say, show me your finest Talmud, and that's the one. The and we'll tell my daughter later. What?
Questions on why is it here?
What do you mean?
If he's just making a nice, you know, marriage arrangement, what's it doing right here?
Mm-hmm. Right, that's good. It's in the conquest story, isn't it? Right, so the answer I would give you is because of what's coming next. It's a good question, but I think it's because of what's coming next, in which Achsa is going to demand certain parts of the land. So it's a good question, but I think that's the answer. The third approach I find to be the most fascinating, although most difficult to accept, and that is the Sfasemes' approach. He points out the Gemara in the beginning of Sota. Right, we're familiar with the concept of Basheret, right? That's all preordained, 40 days before born, and so on and so forth. So the Gemara in Sota actually is a little bit more complicated than that. It says it depends on whether it's first or second marriage. First marriage is based on whatever was preordained. Second marriage is based on worthiness. That's the way that the Gemara says it. So you get whoever's appropriate for you. There's a lot to be said about all of that, but the Sfasemes says if this is her first marriage, if it's her first marriage, so she's going to end up with whoever was set for her anyway. What's the difference whether it's the conqueror or not? It's God's responsibility to make sure that I end up with the right one. If it's a second marriage, then it's going to be whoever's worthy of her anyway, because it's based on merit. So therefore, he has nothing to lose by playing the game. That's the Sfasemes' answer. I have loads of problems with this.
First of all, how old is he? Like, if he's 85, like, how old can that... I mean, how old is she? How old is
he? Well, we don't know... We don't know, but you can, I mean, you can ballpark it. If he's 85, she's anywhere between 3 and, yeah, I don't know.
It's crazy.
But then you can go ahead by that explanation, you can go and make any criteria. The one who, you know, gathers the most roses the quickly. I'm just going to anything.
Yes, except that.
God will make it work anyway, and it'll be on merit, or it'll be on whatever.
Right, except that Kaleb has a city to conquer.
So he just
said, well, let's do that. Okay,
that's the trash taken out. Whoever takes out the trash.
Right.
The whole thing is very strange and very difficult. And the Gemara itself on the Bashir thing is very difficult. But that's what that's the Sfasemes' answer for this. But we don't know, not only do we not know how old she was, we also don't know how old Asniel ben Knaz, mm-hmm. who's going to conquer the city, is. We have no idea how old he is. There's no way for us to know.
But he's his brother.
Mm-hmm. Half brother.
Yeah.
Half brother.
Mother, so others.
Right. Well, maybe half brother. I shouldn't even say that. Right. I'm jumping the gun. Wait. I'm jumping the gun. I should not have. And that drew me into something I'm not ready to talk about yet. Yeah, but there's more to see about that. We're not done yet. We have a lot to see from Radak on this. So that's the set of answers to what Kalev was doing. Either he was wrong, or this was actually not a test of military strength. It was a test of his righteousness and wisdom, or this was actually a gamble he couldn't lose. Those are your three ways to look at it. At least the ones that I've seen. And then we go to Pasuk Yud Zayin, and now we'll get to Nanette's point about Knaz. Vayil Kida Asniel ben Knaz Achi Kalev. Asniel, son of Knaz, brother of Kalev, conquers the city. Vayitein lo es Achsa bito leisha. And he gave her Achsa, his daughter, as a wife. So the reason why this is a problem is because we always call Kalev what? Kalev ben Yefuneh. And yet here, Asniel ben Knaz is his brother. That's a problem. So the Gemara Tmura Dap Tes Zayin suggests, as Rashi quotes, that they are maternal half-brothers. The problem with that answer, as Radak points out, is that Kalev is called Kalev ben Yefuneh HaKenizi.
Maternal half-brothers, that means two husbands, same married a wife?
No.
No, it means sequentially.
Their mother is remarried. Stepfather.
I'm sorry, yeah, maternal, no, it means their mother remarried.
Remarried.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Yefuneh died, and then she married Knaz.
But you're right,
it's not allowed to be married. To one person, two people at the same time.
No, we don't do that.
So maybe they're brothers.
That's the fundamental rule of Pururavu in the Torah, is that by default, polygamy is allowed because it maximizes Pururavu, and polyandry is prohibited because it reduces Pururavu. That's the basic rule until Rabbeinu Gershom. The other rule being that polygamy is a really bad idea in the Torah, as seen by every single instance. But the point that Radak makes is if Kalev's stepfather is Kenaz, why would you call Kalev Hakenizi? Mm-hmm. It's very odd.
Maybe it's the same.
So, person. I mean, but that doesn't make you call him Hakenizi. You either call him your father or not.
Don't they keep their line because you inherit through your father?
Right, and he is. He's Kalev Ben Yefuneh Hakenizi. The whole thing is very strange.
Maybe his stepfather adopted him. You know,
right, so that was that said. But it's.
Maybe it's the same father.
That's what
like right. So Radak offers that suggestion. Radak says there are lots of people in the Torah who have two names. We find that. So therefore, maybe he was sometimes Yefuneh, sometimes Kenaz. But that's difficult also, because again, Yefuneh HaKenizi. Like, Kalev Ben Yefuneh HaKenizi is still strange. And so the answer that he prefers, and I think makes a lot of sense, is simply that Kenaz was the head of the clan. In other words, Kalev Ben Yefuneh HaKenizi of the Kenizi clan. And that Asniel was a descendant of Kenaz and got that name also, you know, Asniel, son of Kenaz. I tend to be inclined towards that more than other answers. I think there are other answers that are also possible, but that's the basic issue here with this. And then we get into the question of, what's the age difference between Kalev and Kenaz and Asniel? But a lot will depend on which of these answers I choose. Mm-hmm. If they're just members of the same clan, there could be decades between them. If their mother got married in sequence, so if Yefuneh was first and Kenaz was second, then Kenaz can be much younger. How much younger? Biblically, anything goes. I mean, we don't, you know, the fertility period doesn't seem to match what we're familiar with.
Saying that Adniel was the one who conquered it, I'm assuming he didn't do it single-handedly. He probably led a team. So is it because he's the leader he gets to marry her? There were probably a lot of other men who were fighting there as well.
Right. So one way to look at it is that he was the leader of the team. And yes, that's why he gets the credit. He rounded everybody up. Or maybe he just rounded up married men. I don't know. Granted, it was the days of polygamy. But the other possibility is that maybe he did do it himself. I mean, it's odd to think so. And it's true that the Mefarshim, when we say things like Vayoresh Kalev or Vayoresh Yehoshua, the commentators do hasten to say it means he was the leader of the group. It doesn't mean that he personally, you know, defeated every last enemy. So I think it's safe to say here also that he rounded up the crew and they conquered the city together.
Unless you go according to the Gemara, if he learned it.
Unless I take the learning approach, right? In which case, all of this is by the wayside. So, all right, that brings us to Achsa and her request for land. But I think what we'll do is we'll stop with that. And the next time we'll do that, because after that we have 44 psukim that are just lists of cities. So that's why we'll start next week with some story piece first. There's substance in there also, but it's a lot of it is just reading names of cities, and I'm really not planning on going through the dot mikros location of each of the cities. Okay, thank you very much.